as I was telling you earlier on, I am a big fan of the stand-up writer Stuart Lee. Whether it's what he writes as a columnist, sleeve notes, his commentaries, but most of all, the chance to go and watch him in front of an audience developing his art. It's pure. Stand-up routine characterized by repetition, internal reference, and deadpan delivery. That's what they've written down here. And we started off in 89 with Richard Herring as part of the duo Lee and Herring. And of course, he was also responsible for writing Jerry Springer the Opera. But that was nothing that I knew about until I actually got him and saw him on a series that the BBC was putting out called Comedy Vehicle between 2009-2016. Went to go and see him, eventually read the books and try and catch his show at least once every time he goes around, whether it's Snowflake, basically, Stuart Lee versus the Man Wolf, which is the latest one, or Content Provider. Anyway, he's really an amazing artist and got a great record collection. So I caught up with him last week and got him to bring a few of his records in and take us on a Stuart Lee journey. So that's what we're going to be doing for the next 40 minutes or so. Talking Billy Harper, talking Derek Bailey, talking Stuart Lee.
We might as well start the way I first saw Stuart Lee when I went to see you at the Piccadilly Theatre many years ago, and I came in and you were playing, it wasn't this Coltrane.
Right.
It was something a bit wilder.
A Leicester Square Theatre. Yeah, Leicester Square Theatre. Well, I mean, I don't mind saying this to you, but I'm aware that it sounds really pretentious, but seeing the connection between a track like that and some of the things that I was trying to do was a real breakthrough for me. The way that flute picks up the main theme again really delicately in the middle and then tosses it away again. Particular shows of the stand-up that had a lot of improvisation in them. What Coltrane does in My Favourite Things was what made me think about how you have to construct it, which you have to let people know that you know what you're doing at the start by playing something that sounds like a tune.
Yeah.
Drop a few hints in over the 20 minutes that you're still on track, and there's, as long as you wrap it up by returning to the main theme, you can sort of go anywhere. And I like the fact that, I mean, there's 40-minute versions of that, you know, where you kind of lose patience with it, and then it wins you back round again. And so, you know, there was one particular tour where the music before the show and in the interval and whatever was as many versions of Coltrane doing My Favourite Things as I could stitch together. There was a very specific reason for that, because I think there might even have been a routine in the show where I was self-aggrandizingly saying I was as good as Miles Davis or something, a kind of joke thing, you know, where the artist, Stuart Lee, overstates the case for his own work, you know. And the first time my sister saw me was at the theatre in Bury St Edmunds, and I was playing loads of this, I remember. And afterwards she met me in the pub looking really ashen-faced and hadn't really liked it. And the only thing she could think to say was that I needed to talk to the theatre staff about the music they were putting on, because it was really awful and had alienated everyone. And I went, well, I choose that, obviously. And it was like, it's chosen for a reason.
You blew my mind. When I walked in, my mate Jez had said to me, you've got to go and listen to Stuart Lee. He actually gave me the book, and I started going to that, and right. I saw you on the TV and that. And then I went to like one of the first stand-up shows I'd been to ever, actually. And
wow.
Well, you know, when you're a DJ, I think there's a parallel actually in what we do somehow. Yeah. But when I walked into the Leicester Square Theatre and there it was, the music was just loud and, you know, the crowd was just waiting for you to come on. It was a brilliant intro. I was blown, my head was blown.
Oh, setting the tone with the music's really important to me. And the comedy club vibe was always, people were trying to find music that would put the audience at ease, right? And I wanted to find things that would make them feel a little bit discombobulated and not sure where it was going. And when I'm writing every show, I normally have a different kind of music in mind as I'm doing it. This one, I listened to loads of Captain Beefheart and Canned Heat and kind of bluesy stuff, because I was trying to think like a very particular kind of American stand-up.
And a lot of them sound like that, you know, the guys that we're talking about, kind of like dogs barking or wolves or something.
And like, so listening to Beefheart and things like that really, really worked for it. And I tend to think more now in terms of the musicality of the way a set's constructed.
Well, I mean, I thought it was interesting as well when you said about how the way someone like Coltrane is going to go to the theme, then take it elsewhere, and then bring it back every now and again. I mean, you are the John Coltrane of comedy. You are.
I'm going to attribute that quote to you.
I'd love to. I think I've already said it before. When did that kind of concept of music and a stand-up come together?
We're at Stoke Newington in North London, and I moved around here in the late 90s. And I'd already gone to bits of sort of jazz and free jazz, but I often didn't really know what I was seeing. I got in and out of jazz as a teenager just because it was quite hard to find out about. I remember being about 14 and somehow stumbling across a BBC radio show playing the whole of Freedom Suite by Sonny Rollins and thinking, that is amazing. Going to the library and getting the record out, thinking it was brilliant, and then trying to get some more jazz. And the other jazz record in Solihull Library was a Grover Washington one, which just wasn't what I thought, is that what jazz is? And then I didn't like listen to it again until I was sort of 18. There was a guy in a record shop in Oxford that would sort of steer you towards things. You used to need people like that, didn't you? You know, you needed a guide, because information wasn't everywhere. And then what was great about, you know, being a fan of a particular kind of rock music in the early 90s was people like Sonic Youth would collaborate with people from jazz and kind of steer you into it. But moving around here in the 90s, Stoke Newington, there was the Vortex on Church Street, which had a lot of quite, you know, like Evan Parker and Ken Vandermark and quite extreme sorts of things were on there. In fact, the first night I moved here, I remember looking at what was on at the Vortex, and it was Django Bates, and it was sold out. And I stood in the street on a late summer evening listening to it coming through the windows.
Did you?
Yeah, which is a really great memory. And then there was a gig upstairs at the Red Lion pub that John Bissett and Ivor Callin ran, of sort of free jazz. Then about 2 years later, Alan Wilkinson started running one every 2 weeks downstairs at Ryan's Bar, and Alan's one of the great British free jazz saxophonists. So I saw a lot of that music living here. And then I started to think about it as performance as well, rather than as recordings, and seeing how those people would hold a set together and establish an idea and how far you could go with things. And also when that music was funny as well, like the real, what you would call free improvised music, where it loses its way. It loses its way, and they you can see that they've tried to box themselves into a corner that they don't know how to get out of, and I like to try and do that. And then another part of me has to rescue me.
Stuart, you've got a show which is about, you're about to go in down at the Alley Pally, which, yeah. That's the first time in there?
Well, there's a theatre out the back, right, which they found a few years ago, and I'm doing there for 2 weeks.
I was reading someone talking about the importance in a DJ world of residencies. And with you, one thing that I think is incredible is that you've always used this residency idea to basically build your work to then take it on the road.
Yeah, absolutely. The Leicester Square Theatre and the Stand Edinburgh, which is another place that I do long runs to work stuff out. Leicester Square Theatre is what I thought a comedy club would be. It's just the right size to work everything out. I can do like 3 months there, 4 months there, five, 6 nights a week. And by the time I've finished that, I know what all the elastic limits of all the routines are and what you can do. Then you go on the road, and every night you're in a room with different acoustics and different vibes, and so it's really great having bedded it in somewhere. Even what the seats are made of affects how laughs sound. 95% of the venues that I play, I do them because I like the sound of them and the shape of them.
You're a mad music fan, and you go into areas that are all new to me. I want to kind of get into your collection a little bit. What we'll do, you just spoke about the sort of bluesy side of things, and there was a record that I saw that you put together for Songlines magazine. And
it had an
Ali Falcaturo track on it, which I didn't know, and it's amazing. So let's get you to sort of prepare some records, and we'll get this one on the way.
Brilliant.
And you're out of the sort of stand-up zone,
yeah.
And you're the music guy.
That's what I've got to do today, actually. I've got to write sleeve notes for a 10-CD box set of Green on Red, the Tucson, Arizona country rock band from the 80s. Yeah, no, I like all sorts of stuff.
So, Stuart, let's take us back a little bit to your early days, and so where you grew up and your first music. Were you kind of connected to the Specials?
That was a big deal, that music.
Yeah.
Growing up in the kind of household I did in the Midlands at the time that I did, you know, everybody was racist. That's what people were like. Mm. And like, the first music I really got into was Two Tone, and it was quite a big deal politically, you know, and socially, to see people cooperating and playing that music. And also it was a good way into lots of different kinds of music, particularly the third Specials album, which is in the studio is a jazz album. It was recorded at Wessex, and I think that Free Nelson Mandela was actually written in a flat on the corner of Green Lanes and Stoke Newington Church Street. People talk about, you know, when you do political stuff in comedy, and I don't know if it makes any difference, but I do know that music made a big difference to the way I thought about the world. So I do know that popular culture can do stuff, even if it's only to comfort people who feel increasingly isolated by having liberal values or something. I think there is a point in it.
Okay, let's play this. Let's play a little bit of Billy Harper, because this is an interesting thing, talking of the change in the arts and the support and the backing of all of that. Yeah. There was a situation with Billy Harper, right?
I was in Stranger Than Paradise Records the other week down in Dalston, and they were playing this, and I went, what's that? And it was great. And I bought it and then realised who he is. And this has been reissued from 1975 last year, and he was in this group, The Cookers, that pulled out of the New Year show at the Kennedy Center on the grounds that when they booked it, it was the Kennedy Center, not the Trump Center. And the CEO of the Kennedy Center, he's told me he's going to sue them for $1 million for pulling out, and that the job of the artist is to entertain everyone and to not make a choice based on their values, which I expect would be a surprise to every single person on every single record, that their job was to do what they were told. Isn't it amazing that 50 years after this record, during that period of jazz, when it was a politicized thing, when they talked about the fire music and the free music, it's still that guy, he must be 80, he's still at the forefront of challenging that.
This is your next pick, The Mesthetic, Fugazi.
You know what's great as you get older is things that you like from different areas tying together. And Fugazi, the hardcore Washington band that is the rhythm section here. You know, they're people like the X, the Dutch group, who do a lot with jazz musicians, that I'd go and see as a younger man, and for about a week afterwards I'd want to be an anarchist vegetarian, and I felt so inspired by it. And then seeing them hook up with people from jazz now, it's great. I took the kids to this.
Stuart Lee is with us, listening to James Brandon Lewis, The Mesthetics. Just did three nights at Cafe Otto, outside of the circuit as a host. Pick the next record for me, because this is, we're going into another space here.
Well, this is Maggie Nichols, who was in the Spontaneous Music Ensemble, which was the roots of European free improvisation. She's in her late 70s now, I think. She's still very passionate politically, which you'll hear in this. She can sing in a conventionally beautiful way, which she does a bit in this. She can also screech and squawk with the best of them when she's on bills with difficult improvisers. She can communicate through abstract sound, through precisely written words that express her feelings, and she's doing all of that on this.
Stuart, thank you. That was a whole complete new discovery for me. Collection-wise, you've obviously bought all of this pretty much on vinyl today.
Yeah.
You've kept on collecting.
Yeah, I have, yeah. Although I'm buying things again now, because a lot of great stuff, like this record that we're going to listen to, came out during the CD era, and I didn't know it was on vinyl. I was in Paris the other week, and I went into a record shop, and the label of the record shop issued this Shoji Hano and Derek Bailey Fish album, which looks lovely on vinyl because it has a large fish on it.
And
it comes with a free badge. A Derek Bailey badge.
Saw that.
Which you could never imagine.
I was going to pinch that.
That's happened. If you want your own Derek Bailey badge, you'll have to go to Soufflé Continue in Paris. They'll give you a Derek Bailey badge if you buy that Derek Bailey album there.
Absolutely brilliant. Yeah, and get there with Stuart Lee. Shoji Hano, Derek Bailey. I mean, a big name as well. Been passed away for a little while now.
10 years ago, yeah.
10 years ago, too. Yeah. He's made that great record with, you had Pat Thomas playing with you recently as well, didn't you?
Yeah, well, that was a week of a tribute shows for Derek, actually, because he used to run these nights called Company, where he'd put people together who'd never played, so they just did that again, and it was, never played together, and it was superb. He was a big inspiration to me, really, in his attitude to work. He worked in light entertainment, initially played in the Pit Band from Walk and Wise and people like that, but not, it didn't sound like this. And then he just sort of walked away from it all.
So Derek Bailey was the one who would never repeat anything.
No.
Right,
yeah.
That's it.
He was kind of against the idea of composition.
Yeah.
As a kind of almost a satirical position, really. Mm. I remember saying to him, but, you know, surely there's some use for music that's written, and he wouldn't have it. And he also affected to... He said, do you buy my records? And I went, yeah. And he went, what do you do with them? Do you sit and listen to them? I went, yeah. He said, what, do you have a cup of tea or do you just sit there? He affected to find the very idea of listening to recording music odd, even though he put out records. Quite a funny bloke.
The last time I played a Stuart Lee record on the radio was several years ago, when you joined up a group, or you did a project with Capri Battery.
From Bristol, yeah.
Yeah, tell us, remind me, because I remember playing it.
I was doing a gig in Bristol.
Yeah.
And they... They said, you're doing a gig in Bristol, will you come in the afternoon and just make up some words with us and we'll improvise in a studio? And I went, yeah, all right. I don't know. It is what it is. The tragedy is there was a brilliant, brilliant track on it. We ran for 20 minutes. And at the time, I was researching a film about a particular thing. And I'd watched a very old documentary about that thing. And I'd remembered a lot of the phrases in it. And I was dredging them up whilst improvising, and then a man claiming to own that documentary said we couldn't put the track out, which was a real shame because it was a real good one. It's in the vaults. I think they all had to be destroyed, actually, as part of the avoiding the thing. But it was just in there in my mind, you know. It's not this one. This one's legal.
How old are you? How old are you? Yeah, you. How old are you? I'm 22, mate. Mate. I'm 22, mate. 22 years old, mate. Mate. 22 years old, mate. How old are you? 22 years old, mate. Mate.
I've not listened to it since I did it. That is based on an incident, bizarrely, that happened when I used to live around here. And I was the moment when I turned from being the sort of young person who would have been making the noise to the middle-aged person complaining about it. About two doors down, there was a house full of very middle-class sounding students. And in the cellar of that house, there was a little old lady who lived on her own in a one-bedroom flat. And then these kids had a party and they sent leaflets to everyone in the street, you know, saying you can come to the party if you want, which was nice, I suppose. But obviously, it must have been hell for that old woman, and it was keeping us awake. And I went out in my dressing gown and no underwear and just some big boots that I put on. I just lost my in the middle of the night because we had little babies at the time as well. And there was a kid in the street standing up shouting to get in, you know, Tarquin, let me in, or something like that, you know. And I was going, just how old are you? I was saying, how old are you? And he was obviously probably quite threatened by me. He just kept saying his age over and over again, and I kept asking him. I got in, stuck in this mad loop. And then through the window, I could see someone DJing with a motorcycle crash helmet on with the visor down, which struck me as so pretentious. It was like Daft Punk, but just in the front bay window of a house. And I just lost my mind in annoyance at it all. And then at the kids' football, about a week later, this guy came up to me and said that I had abused his student in the street.
Can you get our invites? They invited everyone in the street. Me. We said you're welcome to come down and chill.
I'm not a musician, I'm not an improviser in that way, so when people ask me to do these sorts of things, sometimes they work and sometimes they don't, and I don't think I've really got any control over it. I can hear how the horns are trying to follow the screeching of that voice. It did kind of become a stand-up routine in the end, where I kind of noticed that there was a certain kind of age group and class of person that tended to call you mate all the time, often when they were trying to passive-aggressively wind you up or dial down tension on something.
Stuart, it's been absolutely so brilliant having you here.
Thanks for having me.
What great context on that song as well. I've always wondered, all those years later. Amazing. So tell us about the show.
Next thing is the first 2 weeks of February, I'm at Ali Pali in the theatre out the back with Stuart Lee versus the Man Wolf. Then I'm touring it around May until Christmas, and then I'll film it and never do it again. And there's a lot of music in the show. I got the Glaswegian garage punk band, The Primevals, to write a song for it, which I sing. And they've also remixed it in a way that's probably slightly more appropriate to Giles Peterson's show than the original.
Stuart, thank you.
Thanks for having us.